Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast. I'm your host and I'm joined today by the co-host, Max Ada. I was thinking about how to introduce someone who's always on the show.
A recurring guest,
yeah. An unwanted guest.
Yeah.
So we're actually today going to record the third episode of the the training talks segment, which I think has gotten rave reviews from, you know, the four guys who listen to it
yep.
all the time. And actually, someone mentioned having Max narrate an audiobook.
Yeah, that was in the Q&A, right?
That was in the Q&A on the performance community.
I would, but I can't read. So it would be not a great audiobook.
It's just be looking at a page,
yeah.
saying random words.
The snatch, gripe. Brutal RDL mimics the movement. So, yeah, that was my attempt at it.
Yeah. You've heard of nails on a chalkboard. This is Max Ada reading words on a page.
You remember Donnie Schenkel read the Bible?
I do. I
sold that.
He did.
People read that. Listen to that.
Yeah. It's many of the things that he's taken off the internet that he's put up, I don't know where that stuff went, but it's no longer in existence. The reason we wanted to record this, we actually had a really, really cool episode with Alex LeChance. We talked about her background, her approach to just working as much as she does and effectively as she does. And then also, you know, by proxy, Dan Bailey, shout out to Dan, and God's Country Coffee.
Very good coffee.
Very good. Not an official sponsor of the show.
Unfortunately.
Dan. maybe we can get a discount code when we get them back on. So we'll re-record that and we'll release it probably in a week or two based on the fact that they're at the CrossFit Games right now. So we'll do that. And then before we get into the episode, which, you know, we want to cover movement or technique primers, complexes, and then skill acquisition kind of as a concept at large, and then kind of go off from there. So before we get into that, Max, remote coaching, offer it one-on-one.
I do. Yeah. Okay. I've been doing a lot of remote coaching over the years.
Yeah.
If people are interested, then for sure, hit me up.
teamada.com.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I also do some remote coaching at a much more affordable price.
Much more.
And I provide less value, so that's why the price is lower.
Not true at all. Actually, Josh is a very good remote coach. I've seen him work far more attentive than myself.
Yeah. So we're both very good. You can go find me on philosophicalweightlifting.com, Max on teamada.com. Check out Weightlifting AI if you want a program that's, you know, adaptive, responsive, and proven. You can go on the performance community, interact with the both of us. So you kind of have your pick, right?
It's a better product than either of our remote coaching. That's the problem.
We put way more work into that than we do what we do, you know, with our own athletes. All joking aside, the reason I brought that up is because we don't do a terribly good job of plugging ourselves. So I thought we'd get that out of the way.
It's not what I've heard. I've heard you plug yourself pretty well.
Yeah. Of course. Seb is always the one who's like jamming marketing stuff down everyone's throats. He does a very good job of that. And speaking of Seb, if you go to Weightlifting House, you can use code PhilWL, that's PHILWL, for 10% off. You can also use that at onyxstraps.com. Enough of the pluggery. So technique primers. Max, maybe you can kind of set us up. When were you first introduced to the idea of using a drill or like special exercise to prime the next movement in a way that's like not as physiologically relevant? So you're not doing like post-activation potentiation. You're not trying to produce more force. You're trying to be more technical. So when was the first time you heard about or thought about a technique primer?
Like an hour ago when you and I talked about it. I mean, I guess probably like unknowingly or right away in training, right? Yeah. You would do a lot of times you do something like you, let's say you're going to snatch and you start with hang snatches, right? And you're working on a specific thing or you kind of, everyone kind of does this like to some degree with like the empty bar and you're kind of like, I'm going to practice like jumping under, moving around. I think that's probably like the fundamental like concept behind stuff like primers.
Yeah.
But it's not weighted like you and I have talked about it. Because I've in my mind I've always come from doing the idea of like concept is drills, doing drill work, which is like practicing some portion of the movement, generally really light, and then doing the movement. But we've kind of, since talking to you more, like kind of branched to the idea that it's actually like a separation between doing like bar drills that it would be like, you know, a tall snatch with empty bar versus a primer, which would be maybe like not regression from there, but a sequencing from that to like power position snatch with up to 70% or something. Yeah. And then following that by something closely related to it that it augments. So the idea was initially like, okay, you're doing some kind of little technique skill stuff and then you move to the lift. Probably more close to that would be like the actual execution of like power snatches as your warm-ups for snatches, right? So that's kind of where I would say it all started. But that's like right off the bat, like in training. You're kind of always doing that, or was when I started.
Yeah. Do you feel like that a lot of weightlifting now, because it's trying to be marketed and sold, is just like this officialization of things that were like already done, already known, not necessarily talked about, not necessarily sold, but like you have to brand it. And then you have to also explain it in a way that's able to be communicated to other people, but also able to be communicated amongst the same people. So like you always talk about having a sort of like common glossary. Mm-hmm. It's a way that we can communicate like, oh, you know, right after the instant of separation, there's this technique error. It's like, well, we both know what that is. So when the bar breaks and the athlete and the barbell become one system, or it's like, oh, when they started the transition, like the thing that always got me with technique is that people would say first pull, second pull, third pull. Some people would say transition. Some people would say explosions. I don't know what any of it means. Yeah. I'm just kind of like riding by the seat of my pants. Whereas, you know, when we establish this like common understanding of it, we could then start to communicate more effectively. When people started weightlifting, or were like weightlifting before the internet age, or even before it became really popular or like sold, you just kind of did it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I don't know if there was much like communication between people.
I think to some degree, like, because I think there's probably two things. The easy answer would be like, yeah, everybody's just making shit up to sell a product.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's true. I think people are genuinely trying to qualify and quantify what they're doing.
Yeah.
So they can say, like, you know, it's like we create a word like a primer, like do a movement primer so that you understand what it means.
Right.
And it's a shorthand for defining something that's more complex than just, hey, do some power snatches before you snatch.
Yeah.
And so I think that is a large part of it, is that there's that. If you think about like think about bowling as a sport. This is kind of funny, but like bowling, you know, imagine bowling when it first evolved. It was just a round ball that was completely uniform in shape and weight and everything. It was symmetrical, and like the lanes were just flat, regular lanes.
Yeah.
If you look at the science behind bowling lanes and balls now, it's crazy, right? Like they're oiled specially.
Yeah.
Like the lanes do things, the balls do things they didn't do before. So there's a lot more energy and like technology and emphasis and money going into it that changes it.
Yeah.
That's probably similar in weightlifting, in that like there's a lot more thought that goes into what happens.
Yeah.
And so people take that, the ideas, and they try to, you know, put that idea into practice and then define it and explain it in a way that like is useful to people. So I don't think it's as simple as saying like, people are just trying to sell something that way.
Yeah.
As much as like people are trying to do something that's at least beneficial to the community by saying, oh, let's call it this or that. It also is like this, the community and the industry and way of thinking is very like incestuous, in that like lots of the same ideas get recycled. So it's like, you know, the idea of like, oh, movement primers, that's just a thing now and we all do them. And so, I would say it's like, it's probably a little bit of both, but I definitely think it's probably more on the beneficial side. It just happens to be that it's, you know, it's like, this is where I think you and I are in an interesting spot, is to question whether or not it's valid.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it's like, I, in my mind, I always go back to similar to the idea that like there's a natural selection to things that work. like if you see it being utilized in lots of different schools of training at a high level, it probably has some validity. If you don't see it anywhere except one place, it can't possibly be necessary because other people don't do it.
Unless the environment is so different.
Right.
So like, you know, if you have some sort of adaptation that keeps you safe from like this mosquito or something.
Yeah.
It's like, well, if the mosquito is like really specific to that region, it would make sense to have an adaptation to that.
Yeah.
So you like, you have to look at the environment to see if it deems something like useful.
Right. Like if you look at the Chinese, right? Like the body type, the body type of the most successful lifters in China generally looks very similar.
Yeah.
Kin Tao.
Even the supers.
Yeah.
The supers look the exact same as like the smaller guys.
Which is interesting too, because in China, there's many different body types that exist there.
Yeah.
We see it as like, oh, they must all have short limbs, you know?
Yeah, they must all have these freakishly long torsos.
But there's many different types of bodies in China. And so it's interesting that, you see that where it's like, and that might be a question of like, is that self-selecting or is that, selected externally and they look for that body type because this training system that's evolved works better with that.
So do you think it's a matter of with that specific body type, the system is structured in a way where those things fit in more easily, or they look at like, what do we have to teach? How do we have to teach it? And then people who can just squat naturally and beautifully like fit into it. And that like, cause you're wondering like, you would have to think, where's the most friction for getting someone ready to train for the Olympics? And that's like, you know, as you mentioned with a bunch of other countries, they don't have teaching progressions or like, you know, books. It's just like, okay, start snatching. So I wonder if they think that like that body type or that type of person can just more easily pick up on training and do training and become better over time. I don't know, because like a lot of different body types become really good.
Yeah.
Like the Russians don't look like that and they're great.
Yeah.
So why select for just that one specific person?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I would also, I don't know. I think that's a tough question to answer, right? It could just be that there could be many factors. It could also be that like that body type is more common.
Yeah.
That body type is more common amongst shorter people. Yeah. And shorter people generally excel at weightlifting, right?
Yeah.
Like
it
could very well be that like
I didn't think about
the amount of training volume that shorter people, shorter limb people can tolerate is slightly higher. People with longer torsos can generally be heavier per inch of height.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like you might get more muscular, shorter people in the sport. Like there's a lot of interesting, like there's a lot of like, who knows exactly what it is that puts people in that position.
Yeah.
But it's like, like you said, it could just be that like, I mean, this is the system, which is a big, broad thing.
Yeah.
Creates top lifters out of the stuff that's put in, and the stuff that's put in the generally as well are these people that look really similar.
I would love to see some sort of information that tells us, do taller people generally have, how likely is it that a taller person has longer limbs and a shorter person has shorter limbs and a longer torso, and then like see how that scales across heights. Because if you were to say, if you're under 5'8", it's more likely you have this build. If you're over 5'8", it's more likely you have this build. That's probably the reason why, because it's just a probability thing. We're going to get more people with this build.
Imagine if Lasha had the same build as Tian Tao?
Yeah.
I mean, his femur would be like, it'd be 3 meters long or a meter long.
Yeah.
But his torso would be, he would sit on the ground and be taller than Tian Tao himself.
Yeah.
Right? Because Lasha has the opposite. He's very short torso, long limbs.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a really cool idea. That would be interesting to see if that kind of data even exists. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if it's been studied somewhere.
Yeah, it would have to
be. What was that thing we're talking with Chris about? Like the skin?
Foundation?
Yeah. Or like the
anthropometric something.
It was
ISAC.
ISAC.
Yeah.
It sounded like International Association for like skin, skin and face, like skin and body. It was just weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we were talking about that in relation to like, you know, seated height versus standing height to see, you know, because these things do matter. I remember standing next, I got some coaching from a guy, his name's Manuel, and he was shorter than me. He's like 5'8", but when we would sit, he'd be just as tall or taller, which is ridiculous. I was sitting next to you and I think I'm just shorter than you or the same height.
Sitting, yeah. I have a long torso.
You have a freakishly long torso.
For the ladies out there, I've got a long torso. For my wife out there, I've got a long torso. Right. Yeah, but I think it's an interesting – that to me would be cool because then that would give us maybe a more clear picture as to like, you know, different training systems and how they manifest in different places, right?
Yeah.
It's also a question like chicken egg, which comes first? Yeah. Does the training system evolve for the population or does the population select for the training system? Or does the training system select for the population?
And does the training system evolve like much?
Yeah.
Right, because the you know, I bet China has had a sports school for a long, long time, or a system of sports schools, and then they've been processing people through it. So like, how much has that developed in the way they select? But a lot of the features are kind of...
We have to assume that the sport itself selects for a certain body type.
Yeah.
Right. We know that
it does, but different body types succeed. Like Lasha looks so much different than Lou.
Right.
So is it a matter of scale? It's like height.
Right. Yeah.
And when height changes, body type changes.
Yeah.
Because who's the 109 for China?
Oh, I can't remember his name.
Yeah. It's like Z or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he's like, so he's like 6 foot or something, but he looks like a...
I don't watch the beast sessions, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, snatch 200 kilos.
What do you clean and drink?
200?
204. 204. I don't know.
And it's always really interesting when you see like Lee Wenwen or Ming Su Ping. Yeah, they look
that's really cool. Yeah. We should definitely remember to ask Chris.
Yeah, we should ask
about Chris. Skin company, whatever it's called.
Yeah, we should get Seb to look and think about that stuff too.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason we were talking about Primer specifically is because we were wondering, you know, what drives a change in skill or a change in performance? Generally, it's like an actual adaptation, right? So you get stronger, you produce more force. You produce, well, and that like changes a lot of things. You produce force more quickly if you get stronger in an absolute sense. And then you can also change like the power you produce. So if you're not changing a physiological feature of the muscle, you have to be changing the ability to perform and use the muscle. So it's like coordination. And that usually is dictated by load, right? So if a drill is like bar, it's got to be really powerful in how it changes the way you move load, because that's what's driving the adaptation. So then you go drill, primer, primer's loaded. It's like, well, why not just do a complex or an exercise variation that like maximizes load, maximizes the skill aspect, and then you get a big return. So like, the question becomes like, where does it become useless to do a primer or a drill, if at all?
Yeah, that's a good question. As you're saying that, I'm kind of thinking to myself, conceptually, should we look at my conceptual model for like assessing, okay, the development of someone's abilities would be to say, like, you start with conceptual issues.
Yeah.
They don't know how to do the thing they're trying to do.
Yeah.
In that case... Right. Just any exposure to elements that perform that movement will have an improvement. You know, we see a ramping up of their abilities. Yeah. So like bar work, like just practicing snatch. But as soon as they're beyond that point with something like a primer might actually have better skill transference initially, because it allows them to practice the movement with load.
Yeah.
But it's concentrated to the same element again and again and again, right? And then moving from that to the actual exercise they're trying to perform. So it augments that.
Yeah.
Whereas like a complex would be the kind of thing that once they've got solidified skill, like they're somewhat stable, and it's no longer a conceptual problem, it augments the training itself because like we said, you can basically have that same constraint through the entire spectrum of intensities and the magnitude can be greater.
Yeah.
So it's like, I almost wonder if primers would be a much better suited mechanism of training to younger lifters, but not beginners. Yeah. So you basically have like this sort of novice level where they have stable enough technique that doing two dissimilar movements or sort of similar movements, one after the other, is beneficial for them, where a beginner would be a challenge, right?
Yeah.
If you've only done so much snatching and you do like hang snatch, then snatch, like it's too many different elements at the same time.
And when people might say, well, you know, that's not that hard to transition. I've works with beginners who have confused a snatch for a clean.
Yeah.
Where we're snatching and then they start cleaning and then they go to snatch the weight.
Yeah.
And they have like a clean grip. And then they get like forehead height and they're like, whoa, what's going on?
Yeah.
So like the reins come off, like everything gets really wacky with a beginner. So when you say having two dissimilar skills, it actually can be confusing.
For sure. Yeah. And I think if you, the most common thing you see people do when they're younger or newer is like, oh, well, can I just power snatch my warm-ups? Yeah, when it's heavier, I'll just squat down. And that's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
But that might be, as a teaching mechanism, that might be very effective for a certain range of athletes, right? This person who's beyond the conceptual stuff, but not yet to the point where they would benefit more from a complex, in that they need a concentrated dose of the skill or the derivative, and then another concentrated dose of the actual movement afterward.
Yeah. I mean, with that stuff too, it has to be skill focused. I think even with complexes, because the amount of like physiological adaptation that's going to occur from doing, you know, five sets of a, you know, high pull plus a snatch, you're like, the high pull's not building muscle.
Right.
It's not really building strength either.
Yeah.
You're maybe contributing the slightest bit to some sort of like endurance quality. But like, it's like the magnitude is so low. So you have to really concentrate that dose over sessions and sessions and sessions, or you'd have to follow it up with like a high pull.
Yeah.
So I think, again, when you like zoom out, like in a single session, it makes sense. Oh, we do, you know, primers and complexes to improve the skill and build muscle and blah, blah, blah. You mentioned tall snatch for speed.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no one's getting fast from five reps of tall snatch.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't even know what that means to get fast.
Right.
Like, you get fast because you produce more force. You produce more force quickly under the bar, or your mechanics improve. But that's not one single session. So like, how do you concentrate the dose over time? And I think that's where we kind of get, everything gets fuzzy. So we have to talk about like physiological change or skill change. And usually that's over a broader span of time.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely like, it's definitely interesting because a lot of it kind of comes down to this question of, is any of this shit even worth doing?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because the reality is like, and the answer may be no.
Right.
That like none of this is actually having the effect that we say it has.
Yeah.
That's like the biggest hang up in a lot of people's like progression to get better at what they're doing is wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Is the belief that when you explain why something works and then you just really wish that that's true, but reality is like that's just not that way.
Yeah.
Right. Like I've been there many times where you're like, oh, this, you know, we do this and this for that.
Yeah.
And then you have to stop and think like, well, is that true? Does that actually happen? Or is it just me telling the world that, you know, we do front squats to make this happen.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. So,
I think that's right. And I think too, it becomes important when those one-off sessions lead to like a change in the ultimate way the movement's performed. And then the ultimate way that's performed across time. But I've probably done that. Like I'll do a complex or a drill. And I'm like, man, my pull feels so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And then I won't do that again. And it's like that didn't do anything. It's just, it's kind of like training junk, right?
Yeah.
It's just something you kind of throw on top and then, you know.
But then, the question does become like, if you do like a pull plus a snatch and it has
you've been giving me a lot of no foot pulls.
Yeah.
Right. So like the way that's going to manifest is like a big change, especially with someone who's been doing it a while. So do it fucking really hard.
Yeah.
And do it really consistently.
Yeah. And it could be that it's just a matter of like the magnitude of what we're doing.
Yeah.
It primers make sense if they're done with an enormous amount of load or volume.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Yeah. Like a primer for a movement is pointless.
Yeah.
But the inclusion of a second exercise, a primer in your training for your snatching in all snatches may have a benefit.
Yeah.
Right. But then the question is how much of that's just related to, we just change the amount of volume we're doing or we just, you know, allocated more volume from snatching to, you know, power position snatching.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, how conscious is the person of what they're doing? Because you're getting a physiological change, a change to the skill, or you're making them aware of what they should be doing. So like if you aren't invested and you can't like recall the movement so you can use it, it's like wasted training.
Right.
So you have to be consciously involved and able to replicate it. You have to be able to like create like a pattern over time just through, you know, like reps and reps and reps, or you change literally like the production of force pattern or the pattern of force production.
So here's a question.
Yeah.
There's a second side to this, which is like the practical application of primers having a greater impact on adherence and belief in the program. Because the funny thing, we talked about powerlifting earlier today, or I don't know, we talked to Josh and I, he's been living at my house, and we literally just talked about weightlifting for like 14 hours a day. Which you guys think I'm joking, but I'm not.
No, like it's serious stuff.
All day long talking about stuff. But so we talked about powerlifting being a sport where people are much more analytical than weightlifting. About training and the intricacies of training. And it's much more, I would say, focused on the scientific side of that.
Right.
Probably because there's more money that goes into the study of basic strength training stuff that has much more of an application to powerlifting.
Yeah.
Right. They're not doing studies on people snatching and clean jerking nearly as much as they are in bench press.
Right.
Or squat or something. But we talked about the fact that there's a really intense focus on improving that sport from the perspective of like, okay, what kind of research can we figure out that actually benefits us?
Yeah.
Because the sport's so simple, because it's so, there's so little variability in the execution of the lifts. Like, I mean, despite everyone saying like, I got out of the groove on my squat, like you probably didn't, you're just weak.
Yeah.
Or you're not weak enough to make it, right?
Because if you do five reps that are the exact same and then you miss, just like
if you've done 50,000 squats, but then that one maximum one, you got to, like, that was more common with the West Side, like the multiply because you couldn't get out of the groove.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's those kind of errors are marginal in the perspective of like in the whole view of the thing. And so the reason I'm getting to this point is that weightlifting, there's this layer of execution that exists between like, okay, you have a program, you have training, you have technique, all these things. The execution of that is like this gray area that can be either flawless, like Ilya Ilin, he could execute extremely well the training program and do lifts basically to near limit abilities.
Yeah.
And that execution was basically the same.
Yeah.
But then that spectrum changes as people get less and less skilled and the psychological aspect becomes bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people Clark a weight?
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, our primer's going to do this and that. And then you have somebody do a lift and they are afraid to go under the bar or they get scared. So they pull differently.
Yeah.
And so it's like, perhaps things like primers and things like this give greater adherence to a program, which then improve people's confidence in the lifting and in their skill because they believe they're practicing better and they believe they're improving things. And how much does that maybe have an augmenting effect of just adherence to the program or execution of the program?
Yeah, I think that's huge. And I think it's huge too, because I think we've kind of mentioned that a lot of people get caught up and they'll say something like the program doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But like, of course, that's within the, you know, the operate on the premise that like they're 95% the same. Like the programs, like you do all the snatch variations and clean and jerk variations and you squat and it's dosed properly and all that stuff. So I think, then it's those extra, you know, belief like tack-ons, like the primers or... It's like, oh, well, let's do RPE instead of percentage work, or let's just break down the total reps and have however many sets as you need, which like is probably marginal gains over time. But again, the thing about those small little additional aspects of a program is how long are they actually carried out for?
Right.
And then that's going to dictate if it's having an effect, because kind of like the idea of, you know, training a tall snatch for speed. It's like, well, how much of your training is for speed? How much of it is for max strength, right? And then can you actually tease out like how much you're improving on that thing? Because you can say you do tall snatches until the cows come home,
mm-hmm.
but are you actually measuring speed under the bar? Or is it just perceptual? You tell yourself a story about it?
Yeah.
So I think the story is huge. And I've coaches are for it. I just like, yeah, we'll do tall snatches for speed. Yeah. You'll get faster. Power position, power snatches. Oh, you're going to be blazing faster under the bar. Like, you know, nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
But you're solely convinced that that's going to happen.
It's a really interesting thing, because like there's definitely like multiple facets to this from like type of population that is doing the training.
Right.
Like if you're talking about somebody who's got a shot at winning a medal at, the world championships.
Yeah.
like the amount of energy you dedicate to figuring out the right things is high, and like things that aren't potentially improving that prospect of you winning don't belong in the program. Yeah. But the opposite is true almost for people that are like learning the sport, because a lot of it is about adherence. A lot of it's about interest and excitement. And if these things are entertaining and interesting and they feel like they're helping, I mean, the entire industry of mobility that has cropped up around training. It's like amazing to me.
Yeah.
Like the mobility is the thing that has such a like the every snake oil salesman and every like, you know, like fake mobility tool and everything that comes out, like
all the doctors.
Yeah. The doctors and the, you know, it's like, is any of this stuff actually doing anything? It seems largely like it's not foam rolling. Like we know the effect that 30 minutes of foam rolling has on your body is, you know, it's nothing. My favorite one, and I'm going to just rant again. This is the 200 pound, like iron foam rollers. What I don't understand, it's 200 pounds of steel. Why don't you just get a 200-pound man to lay on a regular foam roller? It's the same amount of force going into the foam, like, I'm sure everyone's going to blast me in the comments, but, like, it's like, it doesn't, like, just which direction is gravity going? Like, are you under the roller or are you on top of it? Get someone heavier. You just get a 300-pound guy to sit on you.
That's what I thought you were going to say. Right? 200-pound man to sit on you.
It's like, and it costs a lot less to ship a foam roller or a PVC pipe and get a buddy who's fat, or or just go to a local hometown buffet and, like, you know, recruit someone. But yeah, so that whole thing being said, like, a lot of it's a question of, like, do we think primers and these kind of things have benefit, like, that is direct? Or do we think they have benefit more so from an indirect perspective?
They just keep you showing up, because it's the same thing with mobility. Like how many people know how long you would have to hold a stretch and how aggressively, and then how many times, and then how often? No one knows that. No one can tell me
to
that.
Quinn Hennick and I talked once about like the actual physical lengthening of muscle tissue. We were saying to actually increase the length of the tissue to add cells to the length of the tissue. He said the research would show that you have to be in the same position for like 20 minutes at like maximum tension. And that's exactly what they do with like young gymnasts, right? The like stretching schools and camps they have them do, where like Alex was telling me the same thing. Like they would like lay in pancake stretch for 20 minutes, like at in tiers, because they're at the limit of what they can tolerate. It's like, that's stretching. That's a physical increase in the muscle length, right?
That is interesting. And I think too, there's some cool information that came out about loaded stretching, which is like lifting weights and how it's like just
the squat's a stretch.
Like an RDL, right?
Yeah.
Like bending over and having the weights pull you into a deeper stretch is going to add, you know, like sarcomeres in series. And that's got like some, you know, effects, but like the amount of people who can tell you, you know, a stretching protocol and then do it consistently, it's 0.0%. But if you, you know, you stretch after or before and you train, it's like the training is going to drive the effect. And if you're not training, you're not creating an effect.
Do you feel like your flexibility, your mobility in the lifts improved from increased exposure to the lifts?
I've never stretched.
I never did either.
I don't think I have the attention span to stretch. I'd rather be lifting.
I always believed I should stretch.
Yeah.
But I could do like a pancake stretch and put my forehead on the ground.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always been really flexible too, right?
Yeah. I don't think I was super flexible when I was young.
Yeah.
But like doing the lifts as much as I did, like I got, I gained range of motion for sure.
I think I got a really good overhead position from just doing the lifts a lot.
Yeah.
But like my ability for my hips to move between my legs has always been really good. And that's one thing we talked about, like snatching, you know, snatch body weight. I snatched like 60 kilos the first time. Mm-hmm. And it's not because my technique was good. Not that that's a lot, but like I could just squat so low.
Yeah.
I didn't matter how hard, high the bar went, and just catch it wherever it was.
Yeah.
But yeah. And that's the thing about training, is it's the reason the training program is so effective is because it's consistently applied stress over time.
Yeah.
So if you want to do primers or drills, or complexes. Like, it's just got to be logical and consistent.
Yeah, I think the complexes and primers, because we've been talking about this a bit, is interesting because, like, there's nothing particularly special about a complex.
Yeah.
The idea of combining two or three elements that are different.
Yeah.
The variation and the novelty of it, I think, is probably the greatest impact it has. Yeah. Because if you think about this, right, like, let's say you have somebody who has a really weak hang snatch, right? And you believe that they would benefit from doing more hang snatches. If you include it as a complex where they do a snatch plus two hang snatches, you're essentially doing 66% of the effective training you could for the thing that's most important. So wouldn't it make sense that you would do pure hang snatches and not add them in complexes, right? Because it'd be like, well, the more dose of this I can give, the better it's going to be, right? Whereas, like, you see a lot of complexes too that become like multi-elements that are dissimilar.
Yeah.
So like a power clean plus a hang, you know, power clean plus a power position clean plus a front squat, plus a push press, plus a jerk, right? And it's like all those elements are somewhat different.
Yeah.
So maybe the complex is just really a work capacity. Like, it's just you're trying to accomplish a certain amount of volume for the sake of just being in generally better shape.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like it's interesting with complexes that...
Yeah. I think one thing for the AI that would be really cool is you give a complex and then you give them a scale that allows them to say that it felt technically better. I don't know how you would do this, but it would like have to feel technically better than their normal lift.
Yeah.
That, I mean, because that's what we do when we prescribe complexes or primers. It's like, I'm watching this thing happen and the lift is getting objectively better or it's not.
Yeah.
If it's not, stop doing the thing.
Like, yeah.
It doesn't matter. So you have to see a change in the skill itself. And then that's the only way you know a complex is effective.
Yeah.
There's nothing else unless you're doing it to like fatigue the person.
Right.
Like clean front squat, jerk, or, you know, clean, jerk, clean. Maybe you're trying to fatigue the clean or fatigue the jerk in some way. But like, there's got to be this really tight relationship of you do A and then B changes. And if it doesn't, you shouldn't do it because it's just an endurance effect.
Yeah. It's a very interesting, like, and the reality is we still program complexes. Like,
a lot. Program complexes.
Yeah. They're a definite, like, major component of training.
I would say that I probably never, that's a lie. I just did clean front squat jerk and you don't do that for technique.
No.
You just do that to fatigue the fatigue the jerk.
It's
like a technical thing too.
Yeah. Well, it's you do clean front squat jerk because, you know, somebody might have weak legs and so doing second clean is not as beneficial as just doing a second, another front squat.
More fatiguing.
Yeah.
Technically could get out of position and tire them a little bit more.
Really what it is like the real question is what is the magnitude of change of an exercise to have a more directed effect?
Yeah.
And it might be that like this, we think it's like a bunch of really hard edges, like hard lines, like, subtle change equals variation. Yeah. And it might be that everything is very much a fuzzy image, right? Like the question is like, what is the resolution of that? Is it 4K that we have like super clearly defined edges to exercises and how meaningfully impactful they are?
Yeah.
Or is it like, you know, like we're watching a TV commercial from the 1950s, right? Like, my guess is it's probably more fuzzy for a lot of things that we want to be clear, but you know, there probably are clear edges in some way.
Well, it's fuzzy because the inputs are so varied.
Yeah.
So if you think of fatigue as a constraint that modifies technique or modifies skill acquisition, well, fatigue is, we talked about this morning, like you can't even define fatigue.
Yeah.
It's like a general feeling of tiredness and inability to perform at the same level. So you would say fatigue's a modifier. You would say that the environment's a modifier.
Yeah.
So how many people heard a noise and it like fucked up my technique? It's like, so if you get used to that, you can start to lift with that, you know, noise or the environment, the equipment. So all of these things can affect your ability to perform a skill plus the exercise itself.
Yeah.
Which is why, like, what's the most specific thing? It's competition snatch on the comp platform.
Yeah.
As soon as you take your foot off the comp platform, it's not like one relationship.
Yeah. It's not. Yeah, the correlation's not one-to-one after that.
And that's what we talked about with Chris, right? It's this like flow chart of like comp snatch and comp down, comp snatch and training.
It would be
down.
The second most highly correlated exercise to the snatch in competition would be your last warm up.
Your last warm up. That's exactly right.
And it just kind of goes backwards from there, which is really funny because if you just extrapolate that out, it's a training cycle. If you assume that the training cycle has three 100% correlated lifts in it.
Right, yeah.
Everything else is less than that.
Oh, interesting.
Right?
But if you compete often.
So then the question
every
is.
Every week.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get the most specific practice.
So Abhijayev found this out. And so they had his guys competing like 16 times a year.
Yeah.
Right?
Interesting.
But the problem is the excitation in those situations is so high, the fatigue becomes so difficult to manage.
It's all about managing fatigue.
Right.
It's about managing fatigue and getting a more concentrated return.
Yeah.
Because the reason you do certain lifts is to get an expected return.
Yeah.
But if you're competing and you're like, you actually don't know how it's going to carry over or correlate.
The problem,
it's not a strong stimulus for that.
Yeah. We know that's not a viable way to train.
Yeah.
We also have to acknowledge that like you don't need 100% correlation in training.
Yeah.
The transfer training can still be very high. I mean, we know that increases in your back squat will have an increase in your total. You could not compete and put 100 kilos on your back squat and practice the lifts, and you'd probably have a better total.
I mean, so let me ask you a question. What if you could do, theoretically, this would never happen, you could do all of your training on a competition platform in front of a crowd. How much do you think that would make up or improve someone's ability to perform in competition?
Well, they would probably get better at competitions for sure.
Yeah.
If that's the only way you trained, like anything, you develop an adaptive resistance to it.
Yeah.
Right?
It would almost be too stale to where they go out to compete and they're like, oh, I've literally done complexes and all my volume and everything in front of an audience and on a comp platform. It's like there's nothing to add here.
Yeah. The reality, too, is like we generally see in short-term examples or medium-term examples of that, people doing, U.S. lifters doing competitions close to major events and underperforming.
Yeah.
Right. And so the potentiating effect may be diminished.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. So this was something that I noticed like with peaking, with like Shaco versus Abhijayev.
Yeah.
If you're constantly doing the same thing, there's obviously adaptive resistance at the long term level where you're just doing the same stimulus over and over.
Yeah.
But an abuse of the like psychological, hyped up kind of thing also produces the undesired effect in competition. If you're constantly getting hyped up and max out Friday every week, you go to a competition and like, if you don't have that excited feeling or you don't have that crazy, epinephrine, like you're just going nuts.
Yeah.
It's going to be a terrible meet.
Yeah.
Right. When I trained with Shaco, there was none of that. There was zero like psychological arousal.
Instead of
the whole
like
time,
90% maybe.
Maybe I'd have like 90% like three times in a whole training cycle, And obviously, like you lose a little bit of skill
and predictability goes out the window.
With Shaco, it didn't
really
because the execution of the lifts is so simple.
Yeah,
like you know how to squat.
So then, if you're stronger, you should be able to perform a 1RM at a higher weight.
Yeah,
like there's nothing to
for
argue
sure,
about
yeah.
it because it's techniques there. The force production capability is higher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, because I would have like competitions in weightlifting where we maxed out all the time. So you'd think I'd be great in meets, and we would perform really poorly in meets and weightlifting.
Yeah.
Right. And then in powerlifting, because the technique execution stuff was not an issue.
Yeah.
The sum of the parts of the program was significantly greater.
Yeah.
The whole was greater than the sum of the parts. Because I would go to the last heavy squats I would do would be like 250 for doubles.
Yeah.
And squat 320 in a meet or 310 in a meet.
So how often should people compete?
I think there's a balance. I think the lower your skill level, the more frequently you can compete because fatigue management is much easier then, right?
Yeah.
They're not nearly as draining, and the amount of time you need to actually develop the qualities necessary to peak again is shorter. So beginner lifters could compete, conceivably like, once every 2 months.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like there's also like a practical side of this.
Yeah.
Like I would say four times a year is totally reasonable to have four major quote unquote peaks for a beginner athlete. And that would give them, basically four training cycles.
Yeah.
You could even do like, you could consider it something like a season and do something where you have like a long developmental period that's maybe like 4 months and then do three meets in a row in the span of like 3 months or 2 months.
Yeah.
right? We have some frequent competition. Oh, it's cool. More about developing the skill of competing, and then another long developmental period, then again, and make it more of a seasonal thing. Whereas you could have like an advanced person maybe have 3 meets a year, 4 meets a year, two of which are extremely important, right? And the other two are essentially just, you know, to remain confident in that skill.
Yeah.
But like Ilya Ilin, he took a year off and then did like Worlds and then the Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, like, so that's the reality, is that the higher level of skill is like the more time you need to develop, and there's no need. Ilya didn't have mental game issues.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we're at a perfect place to wrap it up. Actually, this is 45 minutes. Gone by incredibly quickly. We did already do the plugs, made sure we got that out of the way.
You still have your plug in.
I do. and any last words before we sign off?
No, that was good.
Cool. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Again, teamada.com for Max, philosophicalweightlifting.com for myself, Onyx Straps, Weightlifting House, Phil WL, and we will catch you guys next week on another episode of the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast.